Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It is my pleasure to introduce a favorite colleague of mine, Dr. David Holway, and he's a little bit puzzling of a fellow because what I appreciate most about him, or one of the things I appreciate most about him, is his intense knowledge of natural history. You'd think a biology department would be full of people that knew a whole lot about natural history, but actually in today's world, we know a lot about extracting DNA, or we know a whole lot about a certain model organism, or the series of organisms that we study directly. But David knows a whole lot about a whole lot of organisms. And he's one of these people who can identify at a chip any bird that happens by. He gained that knowledge actually starting off going birding with his father in Marin County. His father's here tonight, so when you have pointed questions for David, just remember that his father's here tonight and his mother. But it's his natural history knowledge is by no means limited to birds. If you take a hike with David, he'll know every plant. He'll know most insects. And he's intensely knowledgeable about the ecosystems of California, which makes it odd that what he really studies are these invasive species and these non-native species, such as the Argentine ant pictured here. And the reason for this, I think, it will become quite apparent. David is interested in the effects of invasive species on native species, but also keenly scientifically interested in how natural communities are organized and makes use of these new introductions to study basic questions in community ecology. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. David Holway.
Thanks, Josh, for that introduction. I'd like to thank all of you for coming to my talk tonight as well. So I'm going to talk about social insect invasions tonight and focus on one species in particular, the Argentine ant. This is an insect that's familiar to many of you, I'm sure. It's an interesting insect because it's both an urban pest, Argentine ants come into our homes, and it's also a conservation concern. Argentine ants invade our natural ecosystems where they displace native ants and cause other effects, some of which I'll talk about in my talk this evening. My presentation has five main parts. I'm going to first pick up where James Nye left off in January when he was talking about the importance of bees by talking about the importance of ants. And then I'll say a few words about biological invasions and then focus most of the talk on my research on Argentine ants and other invasive ants, focusing on aspects of their biology, reasons why they're successful, and then discuss a little bit about the human-ant interface. Ants are in the insect order Hymenoptera. This is the order that includes the wasps, bees, and ants, and also a lesser-known stem group, the sawflies. All ants are currently treated in one taxonomic family, the Formicidae, and this family first arose about 120 million years ago in the Cretaceous. By 50 million years ago, ants began to appear in the fossil record. Dinosaurs went extinct about 65 million years ago, to put that date into perspective. So for tens of millions of years, ants have been important components of terrestrial ecosystems. Evolutionary biologists currently recognize about 20,000 living species, but just over half of these are described to science, that is, have scientific names. Most ants are tropical. In California, we have about 250 species of native ants, and most of the diversity in this group is found in tropical rainforests at equatorial latitudes. One of the most interesting things about ants is that they are all eusocial. Ants have reproductive division of labor, cooperative brood care, and overlapping generations. And all three of these attributes are summarized on this beautiful painting of honeypot ants. You can see this queen surrounded by a group of workers, and this is an example of reproductive caste differentiation. So in this colony, most of the reproduction is conducted by the queen. Workers, which are all female, by the way, take care of the brood. And social insect queens live a long time. Ant colonies can live decades. Workers live shorter periods of time. So there's ample opportunity for generations to overlap. I'll say a little bit more about honeypot ants later on in my talk. One of the reasons that hymenoptera are of interest is that eusociality has evolved multiple times. In each lineage shown on this evolutionary tree in a red box, there is at least one eusocial group. So, and that includes the bees that James Nye talked about, various wasp lineages, and the ants. Hymenoptera are of interest because they provide evolutionary biologists with the opportunity to study the evolution of eusocial behavior. Eusociality has evolved only once in one other insect group, and that's the termites, the Isoptera, and they are also all eusocial. Ants are very important ecologically. There are few terrestrial environments that lack ants. In some tropical rainforests, ant biomass exceeds that of vertebrates, and ants exhibit tremendous biological diversity. They're important scavengers, important predators, herbivores, defoliators. They're important agents of soil turnover, and it's difficult, given the diversity within this group, to actually adequately summarize all of the things they do. Ants commonly interact with other organisms and often participate in mutualistic associations or reciprocally positive associations with other organisms, in particular plants and other insects. Some species of ants, for instance, farm aphids. This is a Formica errata, tending aphids. Aphids are sucking herbivores, and they produce honeydew, which the ants like to consume. And in turn, the ants protect the aphids from the enemies of the aphids, things like parasitoid wasps and ladybugs. Other organisms provide ants with nest sites. This is a Pseudomyrmex on acacia. This is from Central America. These are Ferelius. This is a genus that's common in the southern portions of North America. And they're visiting an extrafloral nectary, a gland produced by a plant that secretes nectar and attracts ants. And then the ants, in turn, protect the plant from herbivores. Ants are also important because they serve as prey for many different organisms. Some of them are shown on this slide, and these all happen to be local examples. You might have encountered pit-building antlions, for instance. These are in the order Neuroptera. And as larvae, some species of antlions build conical pits, and they sit and wait until a ground-dwelling arthropod will fall into the pit, and then they'll attempt to grab it with their mandibles. This is a parasitoid wasp that lives in close association with a species of ant in the genus Phidolae. Parasitoids are a combination of a predator and a parasite. They're like a predator in that they kill their prey. They're like a parasite in that they form an intimate association with their host. So if you ever saw the movie Alien, that was an example of a parasitoid. And thankfully, vertebrates don't have parasitoids, but invertebrates do, especially insects. Another organism that consumes ants is this seldom seen reptile. This is the western blind snake, and it's believed to consume ants, mostly ant larvae, from their subterranean nests. Ants are also important, of course, because they influence human culture in a variety of ways. A word for ant exists in many languages, and this reflects not only the ubiquity of ants, but also the fact that all ants are social, and social behavior is captivating. And for these reasons, ants are a source of fascination in art and popular culture. For instance, the 1954 movie Them pitted giant squeaking ants against the city of Los Angeles. And this movie is long overdue for a remake, so we're all waiting in anticipation. Some species of ants are urban pests, and pest species support an industry that's devoted to their destruction. And one of the most infamous pest ants is the red imported fire ant, which is a stinging ant. You can see the stinger there. So I now want to talk a little bit about biological invasions, and I'll focus on social insect invasions in particular. In 2004, the International Conservation Union compiled a list of the 100 worst introduced species, and social insects were prominent on this list. There were 7 species in the top 100, and this is far out of proportion to the diversity of social organisms or social insects relative to other organisms. There were 5 ants, the red imported fire ant, the Argentine ant, which I'm going to talk about tonight, a species of yellow jacket wasp, and the Formosan subterranean termite. Biological invasions occur when organisms are transported to new, often distant ranges where their descendants proliferate, spread, and persist. And the key word here is transported. So introductions occur when people either purposefully or inadvertently carry these organisms into new environments. And this can either happen by accident when plants and animals are stowaways in ballast, cargo, and packaging material. And an example of an accidental introduction that's currently wreaking havoc in our local ecosystems is the gold-spotted oak borer. This is not a social insect, it's a solitary insect. But it's killing oak trees, especially drought-stressed oak trees in our mountains. And it's believed to have arrived in Southern California in firewood. Like a lot of accidental introductions, it's not exactly clear how it got here. Humans also intentionally introduce organisms through horticultural and agricultural practices. Humans introduce organisms for biological control, to control pests, either specialized herbivores or specialized enemies of pest insects. And then organisms also get introduced via the pet trade. When species are carried into new environments, most of those introductions fail. A small minority of introductions actually establish viable populations at their point of introduction. Populations that establish can either remain localized in that habitat or they can spread. And a very interesting example of a species that remains localized in a specific type of habitat is the Pharaoh's ant, Monomorium pharaonis. This is an ant that now occurs throughout the world. You can find it in buildings here in San Diego. It's believed to spread almost entirely by human commerce. Its own dispersal capabilities are modest, but it is seldom found outside of buildings, a curious fact. And this is in contrast to species like the Africanized honeybee, which is a strain of honeybee that was introduced intentionally to Brazil to develop apiculture in South America. And these bees escaped their apicultural facility and began spreading across South America. They were first introduced into Brazil in 1956, and in the ensuing decades spread across South America and Central America. They first got into the United States in 1990 in the lower Rio Grande Valley of Texas, and then got into California in 1994. A very nice example of a species that spread on its own power. Now, when species spread into areas beyond their point of introduction, they can enter natural communities where they disrupt those ecosystems. And it's these introduced species that ecologists refer to as invasive species. So invasive species disrupt natural ecosystems. And a very nice example is the western yellow jacket, which is the same yellow jacket wasp that's here in San Diego County. It's found throughout the western U.S. And it was introduced accidentally to Hawaii several decades ago and has become very abundant in some of Hawaii's natural areas. My PhD student, Erin Wilson, who's just about to defend her thesis, has been studying this invasion in Volcanoes National Park and Haleakala National Park. These are some of the most pristine environments in the Hawaiian Islands, and yellow jackets invade these areas and decimate endemic arthropods. These arthropod groups are all negatively affected by yellow jackets in Hawaiian national parks. So I introduced my talk by telling you how important ants were, and then discuss some aspects of biological invasions. And I now want to turn to the Argentine ant, which is the focus of much of my research. And as I mentioned in the very start of my talk, this is a familiar insect to many of you. It's the common urban ant in coastal California. And you've probably seen it recruit to resources. So Argentine ants, like many other ant species, lay trail pheromones, and workers that find valuable food resources or maybe a new nest site will lay a pheromone trail, and this over time will elicit a recruitment response, and these ants will follow the chemical trail from their nest to that food source or nest site. As their name would imply, Argentine ants are native to northern Argentina and surrounding regions. They're especially common along the large rivers that drain this portion of South America, the Rio Paraná-Paraguay river system. This is a photograph of the Rio Paraná on the border of Argentina and Paraguay. Argentine ants evolved in these floodplain woodlands. These are very interesting ecosystems to study ants because ants are abundant and very diverse. These are subtropical seasonal forests. They're very good habitats for ants. Remember I said that most ant diversity is in the tropics, and these ecosystems are no exception. The ants that live in these environments have to tolerate flooding disturbances on a regular basis. These rivers crest their banks periodically, and this region is subject to periodic torrential rainfall. And different ant species have different strategies to cope with these flooding events. The Argentine ant strategy is to nest almost anywhere. They don't invest much in their nest infrastructure. And as soon as it starts raining or as soon as the floodwaters begin to rise, they'll evacuate their nest, carry all of their larvae and pupae, which you can see in this slide, and move to higher ground. And it's tempting to speculate that this behavior may have predisposed them to surviving in the urban environments of Southern California, where they're periodically flooded by concerned homeowners. As a result of the fact that Argentine ants have very general nesting requirements, general dietary requirements, and that their colonies contain multiple queens, they have been successfully introduced throughout the world. This is a map of the current distribution of the Argentine ant. The native range is shown in green here, and introduced populations are shown in red, and I apologize if anybody is colorblind. But you can see from this figure that Argentine ants are found throughout the world. They do especially well in Mediterranean-type climates. They've also been introduced, unfortunately, to some oceanic islands, including Hawaii and Easter Island, locations that lacked native ants or any other social insects. And this species continues to be introduced, and it's introduced inadvertently by people as through human commerce. Introductions in Japan and New Zealand have occurred within the past decade or so. So many introductions of Argentine ants are successful, and Argentine ants rely on humans to carry them into new environments. Their own dispersal capabilities are unimpressive. And this is because Argentine ant reproductives, or alates, only partially undergo mating flights. And by that I mean that male alates participate in mating flights, but female reproductives, winged reproductives, do not. This is a picture of a male Argentine ant, and you can see male Argentine ants in summertime, right at dusk. The mating flights occur in early evening on warm nights, and they will start to participate in mating flights in a few weeks. The Argentine ant, like other invasive ants, undergoes colony reproduction by budding, and this really limits the rate of spread. So the male reproductives fly from their nest of origin, enter another Argentine ant nest, where they attempt to locate virgin queens and mate with those. This is referred to as intranidal mating or intranest mating. And after that, the males die. And if the queens are inseminated, they drop their wings and leave their natal nest with a group of workers and establish a new nest meters or in some cases tens of meters away from their nest of origin. And this, as I said, greatly limits the rate of spread, and it also creates a very clean demarcation between invaded and uninvaded areas. And these points are illustrated very nicely by this diagram, which was published by Erickson in the early 70s. It shows an Argentine ant supercolony spreading through an old field in San Diego County. The solid line shows the location of the invasion front at six-month intervals, and you can see that they spread steadily but slowly across this field over a five-year period. And it's possible, as a result of this mode of dispersal, to measure the rate of invasion. That's something that you can't do for many animal invasions. One very strong pattern that Argentine ants exhibit in seasonally dry environments is that their abundance is positively correlated with soil moisture. So one of the natural areas that they readily invade is are riparian corridors, such as this riparian woodland along the Santa Margarita River in the northern portion of San Diego. Argentine ants thrive in riparian areas, not surprisingly. This is the same kind of habitat that they evolved in South America. And they spread by budding into dry habitats, but as a result of their environmental tolerances, they're intolerant of hot, dry conditions. They're unable to really spread very far into these dry environments. So this graph on the left shows a common pattern, namely that Argentine ants are abundant in moist areas, and as you go into dry habitats, in this case coastal sage scrub away from the riparian corridor, ant abundance drops off steeply. And this, of course, raises the question of whether Argentine ant invasions are limited by soil moisture. So my former PhD student, Sean Menke, and I decided to test this hypothesis using drip irrigation. And we worked at five different sites in San Diego. And at each of these sites, we located a contact zone between Argentine ants and native ants, put out a pair of drip irrigation lines, and then irrigated those transects, or the treatment transects anyway, for a three-month period, and then monitored the extent to which ants would spread along these irrigated transects for a six-month period. So 3 months with irrigation and then 3 months without irrigation. And we did this experiment in the spring, summer, and early fall, which is the period of time that we don't get any rainfall typically in San Diego. And these are the results of this field experiment, and they very clearly demonstrate that for this species, soil moisture controls invasion. So you can see that when we turned the water on in late spring, Argentine ants steadily increased along treatment transects to mid-summer when we turned the water off. And once we turned the water off, they steadily decreased almost all the way back down to control levels. We completed this experiment in October with the onset of the fall rains. This is very clear experimental evidence that physical conditions determine whether natural ecosystems become invaded by this ant. Argentine ants are a very good example of invasive species. Remember I said that invasive species are those that penetrate into natural ecosystems and disrupt those ecosystems in a variety of ways. Argentine ants displace native ants, and because native ants are so important in many ecosystems, their invasions cause a variety of direct and indirect ecological effects. This set of graphs shows the temporal record of displacement from one of our local field sites. These data were mostly collected by my collaborator, Andy Suarez, who's a professor at the University of Illinois, and shows Argentine ants spreading down a canyon in Chula Vista from one end of the canyon to the other end of the canyon. And as Argentine ants spread down this watershed, they displaced the native ants, so that by the end of our sampling period, native ant diversity was almost completely suppressed. Very unambiguous evidence that native ants are displaced by this invader. The Argentine ant's able to displace native ants for a variety of reasons. It finds food very quickly. If you've ever had Argentine ants in your kitchen, of course, you already know this. Argentine ants are also highly aggressive, and these two attributes enable Argentine ants to monopolize resources where they come into contact with native ants. Argentine ants also raid the colonies of native ants, probably to try to obtain the larvae of those species. And Argentine ants also are dietarily flexible. They especially like carbohydrates, and I'll talk more about that at the end of my presentation. I want to take a few minutes to discuss some of the native ants that disappear from our ecosystems. These are important insects, and they're not insects that really get much public attention. One is Pogonomyrmex californicus. This is a widespread harvester ant in the southwestern United States, especially in Southern California. People who study ants refer to Pogonomyrmex as pogos, short for Pogonomyrmex. And like other harvester ants, they collect and store seeds. Harvester ants like Pogonomyrmex build large mounds, and Pogonomyrmex sting, so people sometimes refer to them as fire ants. But they're not fire ants. We do have native fire ants. One of the most common is Solenopsis xyloni. It's an abundant scavenging predator, and you can see here Solenopsis xyloni recruiting to a dead grasshopper. So one way to tell fire ants from harvester ants is that fire ants are much smaller in size, and they also have workers that range in body size, unlike Pogonomyrmex. We also have honeypot ants here in Southern California, especially right here in San Diego. Honeypot ants store food in the abdomen of one caste of their workers. These castes are referred to as repletes, and they store nectar in their crops for periods of time when resources such as nectar are scarce in the environment. Myrmecocystis is an interesting ant genus, not only for this reason, but it's also endemic to the Southwest. It includes several rare species, and it's also a species that's displaced by the Argentine ant. We also have army ants here in Southern California, and this may come as some surprise. You think of army ants as being insects that you would see in the tropics. One of them that is fairly common in San Diego is Nivomyrmex californicus. These are specialized predators on native ants. And one thing that's interesting about Nivomyrmex is that they really don't see very well, which is odd for a predator. They locate their predators and their fellow nestmates through olfaction, and this is a foraging column of Nivomyrmex on their way to raid a native ant colony. We also have fungus-growing ants here in San Diego. This is Siphomyrmex wheeleri, a widespread fungus-growing ant. Leafcutter ants are the best-known fungus-growing ants. We don't have leafcutter ants in San Diego, although they do occur in Southern California, especially in Imperial County. Siphomyrmex doesn't cut leaves like leafcutter ants, but it does bring back organic matter to its nest. It grows fungi on the organic matter and consumes the fungi, so it's a specialist. And it also practices agriculture. And fungus-growing ants have been practicing agriculture for millions of years. And this is a fairly common ant, very inconspicuous, however, in many of our local scrub ecosystems. And the last native ant that I want to feature is the slave-making ant, Polyergus. This is an ant that enslaves species in the genus Formica. Polyergus is shown here in red and Formica in black. And what Polyergus do is they go out on raids, capture Formica larvae and pupae, and bring those immature stages back to their colony. And when the Formica turn into adults inside the slave-making ant's nest, they don't realize that they're in the nest of another species. So they behave as they would in their own nest and live a sad and futile existence. Polyergus is very specialized for brood raiding. Their mandibles are like ice tongs, and they're able to pierce the exoskeleton of adult Formica that are trying to defend their nest, and they're also well adept at grasping the larvae and pupae during those raids. So when Argentine ants come into ecosystems, these native ants disappear, other native ants disappear as well, and invaded ecosystems can be thought of as undergoing homogenization. So following Argentine ant invasion, there's a loss of medium and large-bodied ants, there's a loss of heat-tolerant species. Argentine ants are intolerant of hot temperatures and dry conditions. There's also a loss of variation in dietary specialization, nest architecture, and behavioral repertoires. And these data on the right show what happens to the body size distributions of ants in invaded areas. These data were collected by my former master's student, Stephanie Glenn, from Torrey Pines, which is an area that still has some native ants. And you can see that in uninvaded sites, there are large-bodied and medium-bodied ants. Head length is a surrogate for body size. But in invaded sites, there are no large or medium-bodied ants. There are only a few species of ants present. All of those are rare, and almost all of the ants that are present are Argentine ants, so homogenization with respect to body size. The loss of native ants and this homogenization affects animals that prey on ants, and one good example is the coastal horn lizard, Phrynosoma coronatum. It's a species that consumes ground-dwelling arthropods, especially ants. Horn lizards, or coastal horn lizards, rather, will not eat Argentine ants, and they seem to require medium and large-bodied ants when the lizards grow up to adulthood. So when Argentine ants invade and displace large-bodied native ants, the horn lizards don't have anything to eat, and they have declined seriously as a consequence in coastal portions of Southern California. As I mentioned in the beginning of my talk, ants also interact broadly with plants. And one interesting example is the coast barrel cactus, Ferrocactus viridescens. This is a threatened plant species that's known only from southern San Diego County and northern Baja. You might have seen it before in Torrey Pines State Reserve. They also grow at Cabrillo National Monument and Borderfield State Park right on the U.S.-Mexican border. And this species of barrel cactus, like some other cacti, produces extra floral nectaries. In this photograph, it's a little bit blurry, but you can see two Argentine ant workers visiting a nectary. And the cactus produce these nectaries to attract ants so that the ants will deter the herbivores of the cactus. And this is the main herbivore of this cactus. This is a leaf-footed bug, Narnia wilsoni. And it's hard to see, but this bug has a beak-like mouth, and it penetrates floral buds and sucks the juices from those buds. So Argentine ants protect the cactus. They're aggressive. But what happens in summertime is that they pull out of areas where the cactus are common. Remember I said that Argentine ants don't like dry conditions. They're often present in areas with cactus in the winter and springtime, but recede from those areas in the summertime. So they are uncommitted partners, in a sense, in this mutualistic interaction. And we've collected data to demonstrate that the cactus actually suffer a fitness cost when Argentine ants abandon the plants. So in the fourth part of my talk, I want to discuss some of the underlying causes of success of this species. And a commonly proposed hypothesis for the success of introduced species generally is that those introductions have escaped, or successful introductions in particular, are species that have escaped their co-evolved enemies and pathogens. So populations of a species that are regulated at a low level in their native range, when those species are introduced into new environments lacking those enemies, populations will increase and populations will be regulated by some other factor, presumably competition or something else. And this, of course, is the underlying logic of biological control. You introduce a specialized herbivore to control a weed, or you introduce a specialized predator or parasitoid to control a pest insect. With respect to Argentine ants, what we know now is that they lack any specialized predator. They also seem to lack any specialized ectoparasite. They may have some very inconspicuous endoparasites. They may also have some pathogens. And these organisms could be used to control Argentine ants in their introduced range. And this is something that we're currently researching. This picture, which is from the San Diego Historical Society, illustrates an ill-fated biological control effort. This says, combatants in San Diego's 1926 war against Argentine ants, the ants munched trees and gardens to such a degree the zoo brought these anteaters up from somewhere in South America to try to alleviate the problem. And I'm here today, and that is evidence that this war was not won. One thing we do know is that Argentine ants have escaped interspecific competitors, especially other species of ants. The biggest enemies of ants, in many cases, are other ants. And remember I mentioned that Argentine ants evolved in the subtropical seasonal forests of Central South America. These are areas where ants are incredibly diverse and incredibly abundant. And by evolving in these ecosystems, one can think of the Argentine ant growing up in a rough neighborhood. And they've gotten tough as a consequence. And we think that one reason why they're so aggressive is that they've had to contend with behaviorally dominant species, such as the red imported fire ant. These are the two most notorious invasive ants in the United States. They both co-evolved in the same portions of South America, along with many other behaviorally dominant species. And my former postdoc, Ed LeBrun, and I continue to work on these interactions and continue to study how the co-evolutionary history, or the evolutionary history, rather, of the Argentine ant may have influenced its success in this manner. Argentine ants also appear to have escaped themselves, or they've escaped intra-specific competitors. In South America, Argentine ants commonly fight with one another, as illustrated in this picture. These two workers are from the same colony, and they're attacking a worker from a different colony. And in South America, Argentine ants form colonies, and in some cases localized super colonies, but fight with one another very often. Colony size tends to be much smaller than in the introduced range, where Argentine ants form expansive super colonies. And we've been very interested in documenting this loss of intraspecific aggression. These two maps show the distribution of super colonies in this portion of Southern California. This is the western portion of San Diego County. And dots shown in yellow are sites that are occupied by what we refer to as the large super colony. And this is a single behavioral unit that extends from the Mexican border up to the Bay Area. In San Diego, we also have three other genetically differentiated and mutually antagonistic super colonies. And where these ants contact one another, such as in the western portions of Escondido, this is Interstate 15 and Lake Hodges, and you can see the distribution of the Lake Hodges super colony and the large super colony in this map on the right. Where these super colonies collide with one another, the super colonies fight very aggressively and don't exchange any genes, so they behave as discrete entities. So what we believe is that the loss of intraspecific aggression in Argentine ants, in introduced populations of Argentine ants, rather, has contributed to their success because they spend less energy fighting with one another. Argentine ants also monopolize carbohydrate resources, and they do this in the native range. They also do this in the introduced range. We think that they may do it in the introduced range to a greater extent. Argentine ants obtain carbohydrate-rich resources primarily from floral nectar, and by forming mutualisms with honeydew-producing insects, especially aphids, scales, and mealybugs. And these are food for protection mutualisms. As I mentioned in the beginning of my talk, Argentine ants protect the honeydew-producing insects and in turn receive food. And I should point out that the ants don't do this to be nice. The ants do this because they get a source of food. And the source of food goes away if it's not protected. So as in many mutualisms, there's an underlying element of tension. When Argentine ants protect aggregations of aphids and scales and mealybugs, those aggregations can increase in size. And these honeydew-producing insects are herbivores. So by protecting honeydew-producing insects from their enemies, ants are, in essence, functioning as indirect herbivores because they're increasing the availability of that resource, which they value highly. Now, we've begun to do a series of experimental projects looking at how carbohydrate resources affect the behavior and growth of Argentine ant colonies in ways that might contribute to their success as invaders. And one of the first experiments that we did was a very straightforward diet manipulation experiment. So we collected Argentine ants from the field, brought them into the laboratory, and reared them in small plastic containers and put them on diets. And we fed Argentine ants sugar water, and we fed them insect prey. We used crickets in this experiment. And this may seem like an unrealistic diet, but in the field, under natural conditions, Argentine ants primarily consume nectar and honeydew, which is similar in many respects to sugar solution, and they scavenge and prey upon insects. So these diets have an element of realism. We fed ants high, low, and zero levels of carbohydrates and insect prey. And at the end of 3 months, we measured the ants' behavior and also different growth parameters. Some of the interesting results are summarized in this slide. We found, for instance, that if you deprive Argentine ants of all sucrose, that inhibits their ability to behave aggressively, and they also become less active, whereas prey availability had no effect on these behavioral variables. So it really seems like carbohydrates alone are influencing the behavior in ways that could contribute to the Argentine ant's success. Another interesting result from this experiment was that we fed ants pathologically high levels of sucrose, and this, of course, has an element of realism with respect to human societies. And in these carbohydrate excess treatments, we found that ants had reduced per capita activity and also had increased worker mortality. We also estimated the fat content of these ants, and by the end of the experiment, they were about 40% fat by weight. So we don't know why they were foraging, but that might have had something to do with it. So I want to conclude my talk tonight by discussing a little bit about the human-ant interface here in Southern California. I mentioned at the very start of my talk that the Argentine ant was a unique species and that it's an urban pest and a conservation concern. And I've discussed in some detail the reasons why Argentine ants are a problem to ecosystems in Southern California. Argentine ants, however, also come into our homes. And they do this in summertime, presumably to look for water, and in the fall, especially after the first big rains. And the reason they come in to homes in the fall, I think, has to do with the fact that by late summer and early fall, things are so dry that Argentine ants are concentrated in areas of adequate soil moisture. These areas tend to be low-lying areas and oftentimes areas around buildings, especially in urban areas. So with the onset of the first winter rains, Argentine ants do what they do in South America. They seek higher ground, and higher ground is oftentimes your kitchen. Now, from a pest control company's perspective, it would be difficult to design a more effective pest. Argentine ants don't sting, they're not a public health concern, they don't vector any diseases, and they never go away. Remember, I mentioned that they form super colonies, so if you were able to successfully kill ants in your yard, eventually they would recolonize your yard from your neighbor's yard. So pest control companies play upon our fear of insects to get people to use pesticides in a rather indiscriminate matter. And these two images come from a local pest control company that, again, we're casting disparaging remarks about insects. In case you're wondering, those are not real ants on the cake. So I hope it's clear by this point in my talk, however, that the interaction between Argentine ants and native ants is in a very important way influenced by human-mediated changes in the environment. Most natural environments in Southern California are too dry to support Argentine ants. Riparian corridors are an important exception to that generalization. And urban areas serve as a source for the invasion of adjacent natural areas. So this shows a familiar scene in Southern California, a scrub fragment surrounded by Spanish-style homes. And the graph on the right-hand side of this figure shows that Argentine ants can be very abundant in urban areas and spread, again by budding, into these dry scrub fragments where they displace native ants and disrupt ecosystems in some of the ways that I've discussed this evening. So a challenge for conservation planners in Southern California is how to manage the biological resources of reserves in ways that are immune from urban areas serving as sources of invasion, not only for invasive species such as the Argentine ant, but other invasive species that favor or require human-modified environments. This is Los Peñasquitos Canyon Preserve, a very nice example of coastal sage scrub in the central portion of San Diego County. And above the canyon, you can see an urban development with irrigation lines going down the unvegetated embankment. And this is exactly the kind of problem that many of our local preserves face. Urban runoff from irrigation and from stormwater concentration can encourage the spread of invasive species, such as the Argentine ant, into these natural areas. So human activities encourage the spread of invasive ants in many respects, some of those I've summarized here tonight. High ant abundance in developed areas encourages the spread of these ants into undeveloped areas. And with respect to Argentine ants, irrigation and stormwater runoff can flow downhill into natural areas. And when watersheds become paved over and made impermeable to water, irrigation and stormwater runoff can concentrate and further exacerbate this problem. These are problems that contribute generally to environmental degradation. For instance, irrigation and stormwater runoff can carry pesticides into streams and rivers, and the effects of pesticide accumulation are unfortunately poorly studied. They unfortunately remain poorly studied. You might remember, if you saw James Nye's talk, however, when he concluded, he made the point that colony collapse disorder, which is currently afflicting honeybees throughout North America, is attributed, at least by some researchers, to environmental contaminants such as concentrated pesticides. And this is a problem that clearly deserves more attention. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Before I do that, though, I'd like to thank my collaborators, my talented graduate students, and I'd also like to draw attention to two internet resources, antweb.org, which is produced by researchers at UC Davis and the California Academy of Sciences, and myrmecos.net, which is the site where I got many of my beautiful images that I used in my talk tonight. Thank you. The question, by the way, was when Argentine ants come into homes, do they kill off carpenter ants? So carpenter ants, as their name would imply, enlarge in galleries in wood. They typically live in dead logs. They are structural pests in some areas. Carpenter ants are much less common in coastal Southern California than they used to because of Argentine ants. So there aren't many places where those two groups meet. And if Argentine ants become common, they will kill off carpenter ants in your house. Yeah, so the question is, when ants come into your home, I guess Argentine ants in particular, are they looking for food or are they looking for shelter? It depends on the situation. They clearly are looking for water in some cases, and when they come into homes in late fall, right after the first big rain, they're looking for shelter. They tend to not persist in buildings, though, unlike the Pharaoh's ant, which I mentioned in my talk tonight, which seems perfectly happy to live permanently in human structures. Argentine ants... And there are some exceptions to this, but Argentine ants will typically move out of houses after a while. If there is food available, though, Pet food, for instance, garbage, they will persist, especially around homes. The question was, with an increasingly dry climate and scarce water resources in California, could we control Argentine ants in urban areas by using less water? I think the answer to that question must be yes, but I have to preface that emphatic statement by saying that the experiments that we've done were in natural systems. So the thing that's complex about urban areas is that they're a fine-scale mosaic of yards that are xeriscaped, yards that are abundantly irrigated, areas with no trash, areas with lots of food. So as a management strategy to control Argentine ants in your yard, I'm not convinced that xeriscaping would really do the trick, because Argentine ants could come in from surrounding areas. But it certainly couldn't hurt. The main native ants?
Yeah.
There are a variety of species. Riparian corridors in and of themselves are not particularly diverse habitats. Some of the most common native ants are Tapanoma sessile, which is a widespread ant, occurs all over North America. It's perhaps one of the most widespread ants on this continent. Liomatopum occidentale, the velvety tree ant, is another common ant in riparian areas. Different species of Formica also occur in riparian areas. It's a hard thing to document. So these raids occur typically in the springtime, and you can actually see them at this time of year. Argentine ants are raiding harvester ant colonies in many parts of San Diego, especially on days when we get persistent overcast. Those are days that stay cool enough for Argentine ants to forage into the middle of the day. There are also conditions where harvester ants are active. The Argentine ants will go into the harvester ant's nest, and we think what they're doing is attempting to kill off the colony so that they can access the larvae. But it's a difficult thing to actually witness. At some point, the colony collapses. But unless you're there at the moment that it does, and the Argentine ants take away all the larvae, it's impossible to know that for sure.
They're taking away to enslave them?
No, I'm sorry. They eat them as food.
Oh.
Yeah. The question was, why did Argentine ants lose intraspecific aggression in their introduced range? There are several contributing factors. Most introduced populations of Argentine ants exhibited a profound genetic bottleneck when they were introduced. The cues that Argentine ants use to discriminate nestmates from non-nestmates are cuticular hydrocarbons. So there's a positive correlation between cuticular hydrocarbon diversity and genetic diversity, and a positive correlation between genetic diversity and whether or not the ants fight. So there probably are also environmental conditions that created circumstances that favored the formation of supercolonies. And localized supercolonies do occur in South America. So this ant was poised to become supercolonial in a sense. But you never find the vast supercolonies that you find in the introduced range in the native range. The large supercolony that occurs in California, like I said, extends from San Diego to the Bay Area. There's another very large supercolony in Europe that extends along the shoreline of the Mediterranean from Italy around the Iberian Peninsula to southern Portugal. So just to give you an example of how big those colonies are, and you never see things like that in the native range. So the question is, when Argentine ants come into your home, does the invasion pose a health risk? It does not, as far as I know. The health risk that might result is when you use pesticides. So many of the household pesticides that people control ants with are very toxic substances. So and those clearly can pose health risks. So I'm not in the pest control business. So and I would hesitate to really offer technical advice about how to keep ants out of your home. But using their natural history, their proclivity to tend aphids and scales, their moisture-loving habits, those characteristics can be used against them. So by xeriscaping and removing food sources, keeping garbage contained, you can make the environment less suitable for Argentine ants. And that should keep numbers down. Will it keep them out of your house? It's not really easy to say. Yes?
Oregano.
Yeah, so there are a variety of substances that you can use to control Argentine ants. In organic farms here in San Diego, people use boric acid. You can buy boric acid in any drugstore. And a dilute solution of boric acid and sugar will kill Argentine ants, and it's fairly non-toxic. So the question is, when ants are protecting aphids, what exactly do they do to protect them? They are bodyguards. So the aphids have a variety of enemies. Aphids are in the unfortunate position of being very soft-bodied and also immobile. They have beak-like mouthparts that are stuck into the plant, so they're sucking herbivores. And some species of aphids literally can't move, so they're in a difficult situation. Their predators include things like ladybugs and lacewings. They also are afflicted by parasitoids, and the ants will actively chase away those enemies. So they provide protection in that manner. Yeah, that's a very good question. And the question was, for these very large super colonies, would you expect genetic differentiation at one end of the super colony versus the other? And I've done quite a bit of work on the population genetics of Argentine ants and super colony formation. And in most super colonies, you see very little genetic differentiation. So there's gene flow through males, which, remember, participate in mating flights. But I think the really important source of gene flow is human commerce. So these colonies get distributed by people all the time. And even though they can't disperse very far on their own, even though one end of the super colony is a long ways away from the other end of the super colony, those ants are moved around inadvertently by people constantly. The question was, how do you recognize Argentine ants? So Argentine ants are about 2 to 3 millimeters in length. They're dark brown. They don't have a stinger. They oftentimes form recruitment trails. They don't have any noticeable strong odor. They're by far and away the most common ant in coastal California, in urban and suburban areas, also in many riparian areas. So the question was, what is the lifespan, and do they rest or do they go all the time? There aren't good data for lifespans in many ant species. Queens, as I mentioned at the very start of my talk, live much longer than workers. Workers are a disposable caste, in essence. They live a few months in most cases. Queens and the Argentine ant are not very long-lived. They live a couple of years at most. And do they ever stop foraging? On warm nights and warm days, they will forage constantly. So that's not to say that an individual will forage constantly. They probably do rest periodically. But if the conditions are suitable, they'll forage during the day and during the night. Well, so the insects produce honeydew because they feed on a diet of plant sap that's very low in nutrient value. And they all sap-sucking hemipterans, that's the insect order that those insects are in, produce honeydew of one form or another. Not all species are ant-tended. Not all species need to be protected by ants because they don't have the same kinds of enemies. How do we find super colonies? Well, we go out into the field and we collect ants and see if they fight with one another. And these data were mostly collected by my former postdoc, Melissa Thomas, who's in Perth, Australia now. And she did literally thousands of fighting trials all throughout San Diego. My colleagues have done fighting trials all throughout Northern California. And Melissa put together this map, and you can see how much work went into it. She spent about a year mapping out the territory boundaries between these two super colonies so that we could study how aggressive they were and the extent to which there was gene flow between the colonies. So, and you can do these tests yourself. They're not hard to do. You can take ants from different areas and put them together in a small container, and more often than not, they won't fight. But you might get lucky and find a new super colony, and if you do, I'd like to hear about it. The question was, do Argentine ants coexist with termites? It's not something I know a lot about. Termites and ants have a very antagonistic relationship. Lots of things like to eat termites. So when ants can get at termites, they will. But termites know this, and they protect their colonies. They're also eusocial, like some ants. They have a soldier caste to defend against ants and other enemies. I don't think ants or Argentine ants in particular, are really an effective means of termite control, though.
Well, with that, let's thank Dr. Holloway for a stimulating lecture.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.